The following program is a presentation of the North Carolina Reading Service, and it's intended for our audience of blind or print-impaired listeners. And it is Indie Week, The Independent. I'm John Federson, your reader today. And the issue this week is January the 22nd of 2026. And it's being recorded on Thursday, the 22nd. It'll be first broadcast on the 25th, just about time for the winter warning storm to slam down on our listening area. A little more about that in just a moment. We don't know when it will hit, but we know it's going to involve gallons and gallons of water or ice or snow, power outages, etc. And I'll just mention in passing that on a previous news broadcast, and in fact on every live broadcast that you hear on NC Radio Reading Service today and tomorrow, you will hear announcements including checklists and preparedness lists that have been put together by the American Disabilities Act people and emergency coordinators and people who know what they're talking about what kind of things to stash for yourself. You can't just run back and forth carrying Cheerios, although that's not a bad idea, and what to do if you have to evacuate, what to make sure you have now, and now is actually close to the latest time that you should be looking for this stuff if you need to get it, because you can bet you're following a long line of people who've already been buying it. So preparedness, it's coming. It's going to be here. I've seen plenty of maps and heard plenty of announcements about it. It might close down our listening area here in central North Carolina and even south for a good many days. You may be without things. Let's not endanger our health. So check out those disaster lists if I have time left in this broadcast. We're short on articles from the Indie Week this week, and it may be a time to revisit some of those announcements. At any rate, let's get busy with something other than me blathering. First off, from Carrie, yet another article about Carrie's senior management team departing the town government. This is a fairly short, but it's connected to other articles on this same subject that we've been reading over the last couple weeks. Dan Ault, an assistant town manager and chief innovation officer for the town of Cary, resigned earlier this month, leaving open one of four assistant roles that report directly to the town manager. Ault's departure came less than 1 month after his former boss, Sean Stiegel, resigned following alleged misappropriation of town funds and abuses of power. The State Bureau of Investigation opened a criminal inquiry into Stiegel's spending last week at the request of the Wake County District Attorney and Cary Police. A town spokesman confirmed that Ault had resigned on January 8, but did not immediately respond to Indy's questions about whether his resignation was related to Stiegel's. Ault himself has not responded to a request for comment. Ault reported directly to Stiegel for about 17 years, first in Elgin, Illinois, and then in Cary. In 2008, Ault worked as an intern for the city of Elgin, where Stiegel was city manager. And in 2010, Stiegel tapped Ault to help with the rollout of Elgin's 311 citizen information service. In 2016, 4 months after he accepted the Cary town manager position, he recruited Ault to come work with him again and help launch a similar 311 program in Cary. In his book, The Top of the Arc, ARC, published last August, Stiegel wrote that he and Ault shared a similar zest for local government. He recounted, "We both recall wanting to be city managers at ridiculously young ages." In another passage, Stiegel wrote, "Ault quote, was very bright. He was tech savvy. He embraced responsibility. He worked his ass off, and he would never surrender to can't. Surrendering to can't, in Stiegel's parlance, means accepting the status quo rather than innovating. According to a 2021 organizational chart, Alt managed Carey's 311, research and development, public works, and neighborhood services departments. An updated version of the chart from January 7, 2026, one day before he resigned, showed Alt still reporting to the town manager, but with no departments to oversee. Departments that Alt formerly oversaw were reassigned to other assistant managers and the chief strategy officer. Former deputy town manager Russ Overton was sworn in as Carey's interim town manager last month. The town did not immediately respond to a question about any other recent town staff departures. Over to Durham Public Schools now, and more legal issues. Three administrators there have been indicted on charges related to 2024 child abuse case. Various charges involving obstructing justice and perjury. A representative for the school district confirmed to the Indy that Deputy Superintendent Tanya Giovanni, Senior Executive Director of Employee Relations Aisha Hunter, and Eno Valley Elementary School Principal Tonya Wright have been suspended with pay since December 19th. In a message to families this morning, Superintendent Anthony Lewis said the district is conducting its own, quote, thorough review. The charges are related to the investigation of a 2024 child abuse case in which a staff member tied an autistic student to a chair at Eno Valley Elementary. Lewis confirmed in his email to families, quote, these allegations were reported to law enforcement and the instructional assistants involved resigned shortly thereafter. This week's indictments accused the three administrators of, in different ways and manners, obstructing that police investigation. Giovanni, who has emerged as a key member of Lewis's cabinet in ongoing meetings with the DPS Teachers Union, has been charged on five counts of felony obstruction of justice. One of the charges states Giovanni, quote, did not produce evidence that was in the possession of Durham Public Schools in response to a search warrant and court orders. She was booked into the Durham County Jail on Wednesday morning and released on $10,000 bond an hour later. Per court records, she's scheduled for her first appearance on January 26. Hunter is accused of six counts of felony obstruction of justice and two of perjury. One of those counts of perjury describes Hunter as, quote, falsely asserting under oath that she did not have any notes of the investigation to review. Wright is accused of three counts of felony obstruction and one of perjury. The indictment against Wright charges she was aware of a photo of the child tied to a chair, but falsely stated under oath that she only became aware of it when it was, quote, anonymously slipped under her door. Giovanni, Hunter, and Wright did not immediately respond to Indy's request for comment. Lewis told families via email, we are cooperating fully with the Durham County District Attorney's Office and remain focused on ensuring a safe environment for every student we serve, she told families via email. All right, I'm on the site of the Indy Week, and I'm seeing an article issued since I printed up the earlier ones to read, again connected to the Carey Town Government, written and published today by Chloe Bowl. The Cary Town Council will discuss a proposal to spend $150,000 on an internal investigation into the former town manager, Sean Stiegel, and another $100,000 on a, quote, employee engagement initiative at its regular meeting this evening. That's tonight, Thursday. Both items are part of a bigger effort to repair community trust following Stiegel's resignation over alleged misuse of town funds and abuses of power. Since Cary announced Stiegel's departure in mid-December, residents have been clamoring for more transparency from town leaders about his spending, workplace conduct, and the town council's oversight of him. The council, for its part, has been discussing potential reforms and how to check the town manager's authority going forward. Cary Mayor Harold Weinbrechten announced plans for the internal investigation last month. Immediately following Stiegel's resignation, Weinbrechten said the town had hired Womble Bond Dickinson, a law firm that specializes in employment investigations, to, quote, join us in looking deeply into Stiegel's activities to ensure we are fully aware of any problems and that we put process changes in place so that something like this will never happen again in Cary. It's not clear if the law firm has commenced its review. In addition to that internal investigation commissioned by Cary, the state auditor and the State Bureau of Investigation are each investigating Stiegel's spending. In public statements, Weinbrecht has welcomed the dual investigations and promised the town will cooperate fully. According to the agenda for Thursday's council meeting, that's today, our day when I record this, the Employee Engagement Initiative would include a survey of Town of Cary staff, which is approximately 1,300 people. Earlier this month, Weinbrecht told Indy he had asked Stiegel to commission a staff satisfaction survey multiple times prior to his resignation, but it never happened. Weinbrecht said he wished he had pushed harder for that survey, since he later learned that Stiegel, quote, was unpredictable in the workplace, doing things, saying things to certain staff members that were inappropriate, and they felt like he was not being the leader he once was, unquote. The meeting agenda notes that the $250,000 total in proposed investigative spending would come from Cary's general fund as a mid-year appropriation. Parenthetically, Cary's total budget for fiscal 26 is about $500 million, with about $7 million set aside for mid-year appropriations. The internal investigation and employee engagement initiative are not the first changes prompted by Stiegel's departure, and they're unlikely to be the last. Weinbrecht previously told Indy that interim town manager Russ Overton will not hold one-on-one meetings with council members as Stiegel did, but will include more people and better documentation. Weinbrecht also said he wants to make the annual budget process more transparent to the public. There was a town council work session at January 8th, and there, council members Sarika Bansal and Lori Bush asked staff for more information and updated recommendations related to the town manager's spending authority, the town's fund balance, the external audit process, senior staff travel expenditures, and the land acquisition process, noting that they knew staff were already looking into some of those topics. Bansal said during that work session, these discussions will help strengthen trust and ensure we are fulfilling our responsibility to the residents we serve. And town staff are preparing a report based on the request by Bansal and Bush, which they will present at a future council meeting. We're jumping around a bit now from articles I can still find from the recent week's happenings. This one, titled "A Local Okinichi Site Is Now a World Monument." And it closes, the Buc-ee's is still coming. The Great Trading Path was recently named on a notable list of endangered historic sites, in part due to the forthcoming Buc-ee's in Mebane. Whether the gas station is actually being built on that path remains disputed. Looking at the sprawling construction site near I-40 in Mebane, cars whizzing by, it's hard to picture how this swath of land looked hundreds of years ago when, some activists say, indigenous people traversed it at a as a trading route. On a Saturday afternoon, Crystal Cavalier Keck is asking a group of about 30 people to try. She gestures toward a nearby tree with a thick limb jutting out at a right angle, tells the group to look at where the limb is pointing. Cavalier Keck is a member of the Okinichi Band of the Saponi Nation, and tracing her finger from the tree across the street, that was one of the ways we marked our path. And her finger moved to the 32-acre expanse where a new Buc-ee's, spelled B-U-C-E-E-S, projected to be the world's largest convenience store, is expected to open by May 2027. This is the final stop on a four-hour trek organized by Seven Directions of Service, an environmental justice organization helmed by Cavalier Keck, along portions of the historic Okinichi Great Trading Path, an ancient route that once linked tribal nations from present-day Virginia through the Carolinas. The trek is meant to honor a bittersweet new designation. In November, the trading path was selected for the World Monuments Watch List. That's a biennial catalog of historic places facing threats from climate change, development, tourism, and war. The application for the designation, which Cavalier Keck completed with help from tribal elders and Orange County's Register of Deeds, highlighted development pressures, like Buc-ee's, as threats to the path. That path was only one of only two sites in the United States to be placed on the list last year, and one of 25 in the universe. Other honorees included a Buddhist monastery in Mongolia, the historic urban fabric of Gaza, and the moon. That designation is largely symbolic. It won't prevent development on the trading path or offer legal protections, but it will bring international attention to that path and strengthens Seven Directions' ability to fundraise for historical markers along it, something the group requested from the state but was denied, according to Cavalier Keck. Whether the Buc-ee's site sits directly on the trading path has been a point of contention. A 1997 state survey of the property, conducted for an unrelated project, found no evidence of the path per a letter the State Historic Preservation Office sent to Buc-ee's after the company inquired about the site. Moreover, the Okinichi Tribe Light leadership has never opposed the Buc-ee's. A tribal chairperson, Tony Hayes, told UNC Media Hub in 2024, quote, "We have found no evidence that this was any part of a burial site or that any Okinichi remains were found in the area." Asked about the lack of physical evidence, Cavalier Keck wrote in a statement to Indy, she could not, quote, "claim absolute certainty about one parcel." She pointed to oral histories from longtime local families who described finding arrowheads and pottery on the land, but conceded, quote, "The strongest claim is not that the trading path can be proven to run through one exact modern parcel beyond dispute, but that the area constitutes a historically significant indigenous travel and trade landscape." And in the context of the World Monuments Watch designation, she says, there's no dispute that the path generally faces threats from development. Saturday's trek attracted a mix of tribal members and other local residents, most of whom have participated in past Seven Direction actions, like opposition to the MVP Southgate pipeline. It included a stop in Hillsboro, where an elder Okinichi member displayed items that would have been traded on the historic path, like a seashell for scraping crispy bits from cooking pans, and a gourd that could serve as a baby rattle or water carrier. At another stop, the group filed into the woods to visit what Cavalier Keck described as an untouched segment of the path tucked behind a residential property. Talking loudly to be heard over a dog barking in the backyard of the residence, Cavalier Keck urged attendees to imagine the landscape before fences and houses. And she said what stands here now was built on top of indigenous movement, not in its absence. She told the Indy that Seven Directions hopes to make the trek an annual event each January. Ultimately, she envisions it as a weeks-long journey where participants ride horses hundreds of miles along the historic path. Now our feature article, the longest article in this issue of Indy Week. The author of this, Emily Vespa, The Enduring Hazards of College Hazing. Not long after midnight, late November 1974, 10 young men scattered down Avent Ferry Road in Raleigh, wearing nothing but molasses and cornflakes. Their destination, the Pi Kappa Phi House on North Carolina State University's Fraternity Court. Some cut through neighboring yards as they fled the nearby woods, where fraternity members left them as part of Hell Week, which leads to initiation. Witnesses called the police, who arrested a 19-year-old on a charge of indecent exposure. The others got away. NC State student newspaper technician reported at the time. Shortly after, the university's Fraternity Standards Commission found Pi Kappa Phi guilty of hazing. As a punishment, the fraternity's national office ordered the chapter to end Hell Week and, quote, any traditional activities defined as hazing. Yet, 48 years later, November 2022, NC State administrators received an anonymous complaint that alleged Pi Kappa Phi members ditched pledges several miles from the fraternity house and forced them to find their way back in an, quote, abandonment challenge. Records obtained by the Assembly, where this article initially appeared, showed a university investigation in partnership with Pi Kappa Phi's national office confirmed the claim. NC State and the fraternity's headquarters found the chapter responsible for hazing, put it on probation until 2024, and imposed educational sanctions, including a requirement that members sign an agreement to abide by the hazing policy. That the chapter seemed to continue this modified initiation rite, despite attempts to reform its culture, is not unusual. The Assembly found, in a review of more than 1,500 pages of public records from five state universities. The records offer a glimpse into previously unreported hazing incidents and the investigations that followed. Pledges from various fraternities alleged they endured forced alcohol consumption, sleep deprivation, sexual harassment, verbal abuse, and humiliation at the hands of members of the very groups they sought to join. In disciplinary hearings, fraternity brothers have described hazing as institutionalized, a part of their organization's tradition. Some members, according to records, have deceived administrators in apparent attempts to thwart university investigations. Some chapters were sanctioned only to haze again. Under North Carolina law, hazing is a crime and schools across the state prohibited. But the records, along with a review of court statistics and years of contemporaneous news reporting, show it's still a widespread issue that authorities have at times struggled to probe and prosecute. In an email statement, spokesperson for the North American Intrafraternity Conference, Hillary Brewer, said the Fraternity Trade Association has advocated for federal and state anti-hazing legislation for more than a decade. Brewer said, NIC member fraternities stand united in providing positive, hazing-free, meaningful membership experiences that strengthen and develop young men. A new state law that took effect last month is aimed at cracking down on hazing, in part by closing a loophole that lawmakers said may have allowed perpetrators to escape liability. But some, including the mother of its namesake, say more must be done to hold institutions and people accountable. This is Leanne Kowiak. Her son Harrison, a student at Lenoir Ryan University in Hickory, died in 2008 after a hazing incident. And she said in an interview, "I can't bring my beautiful son back, but I can do what I can to hopefully prevent this from happening to other students." Disciplinary records from Appalachian State University, East Carolina State University, North Carolina State, UNC Charlotte, and UNC Wilmington document the sometimes steep costs of brotherhood. The assembly requested records from public universities that had posted disciplinary actions against fraternities on their websites. These universities provided fraternity case files, many of which include documents marked confidential. After multiple requests, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill released a partial case file with heavy redactions and declined to provide a legal reason for the redactions. The records obtained by the assembly show 14 cases in which various fraternity chapters were found in violation of hazing policies. Hazing is generally defined as any degrading or dangerous activity expected of someone joining or participating in a group, regardless of the person's willingness to partake. The documents, which span from 2019 to 2025, include allegations that fraternity members called pledges racial slurs, forced them to hold a plank position on bottle caps, and made them consume alcohol and other substances, such as a concoction that contained, quote, hot sauce, milk, chewing tobacco, cigarette butts, and at times bodily fluids like urine. Another chapter made pledges eat a habanero pepper while planking and then drink a mixture of hot sauces, records show. Three new members reportedly vomited. In one instance, a student who attempted to join Sigma Tau Gamma at ECU in 2019 reported that at a party on bid night, which marks when new members officially accept a bid to join, pledges were forced to drink to the point of blacking out. The investigative report said the more a new member stated they did not want to consume alcohol, the more alcohol the brothers gave them. The student said pledges spent the night at the chapter house where the brothers yelled at them if they fell asleep. According to the report, the next morning pledges were ordered to drive home. At least one told the brother he still felt intoxicated and didn't think he could safely drive, and the brother dismissed the concern and told him to drive anyway. Sigma Tau Gamma's headquarters worked with ECU to investigate. The school found the chapter responsible for hazing and other violations, including providing false information to the university. As punishment, ECU issued a 9-month suspension, followed by a 3-month probation, and required the chapter to complete an improvement plan proposed by its president. Other records contain evidence that Pi Kappa Alpha at NC State ordered pledges to supply 3 pictures of Rush tits by reaching out to women on this and other campuses to solicit photos of their breasts. That's an activity that's been documented at other fraternities across the country. An official from NC State wrote in a 2019 letter to the fraternity, "Not only was the chapter responsible for holistically sexually harassing women, but they were encouraging individuals to participate in this behavior as well." The chapter pleaded responsible for hazing and was banned from NC State until 2023. In 21, NC State revoked Beta Theta Pi's recognition after it found the chapter forced pledges to sort a carton of sprinkles by color in a room with matches as the only source of light. The chapter members also demanded a pledge watch a new pornographic movie every day and post a review on Snapchat, documents show. And in 22, UNC Charlotte suspended Kappa Sigma for 5 years after the university reportedly obtained videos of various hazing acts, including of pledges duct-taped to a tree, holding large logs, while members yelled at them to recite information about the fraternity. The experiences haunted some pledges, records show. Lambda Phi Epsilon at NC State required new members to keep diary entries, in which some pledges talked about, quote, having breakdowns at hours-long lineups, where members would quiz them on facts about the fraternity in a chaotic environment, according to a 2022 university investigative report. The report referenced chapter meeting minutes and materials where brothers were encouraged to yell at pledges during lineups, concluding that the group, quote, created events with the goal to create mental harm. The chapter accepted responsibility for hazing and was sanctioned. In a few instances, universities partnered with the fraternity national headquarters to investigate allegations of wrongdoing, according to the documents. Some chapters cooperated with these. At a 2019 disciplinary hearing, where NC State's Kappa Sigma accepted responsibility for hazing, one member, quote, reflected that the chapter had lost its way, and there has been a culture within the chapter where hazing has been allowed to continue. He described the acts of hazing as something that had been used for new members to earn their spot in the chapter. In several cases, chapters said the hazing was perpetrated by a small number of members and didn't reflect the university or the fraternity as a whole, pardon me. Other chapters were recalcitrant, show records. Investigators described members as evasive or secretive, and at times wrote that members coordinated their responses to questions or provided false information to officials. Sometimes witnesses were cowed into silence for fear of reprisal from fraternity members. In contrast to legal proceedings, university disciplinary procedures are designed to prioritize student growth and education. Schools and fraternity headquarters often imposed educational sanctions, like obligatory anti-hazing workshops, on chapters that they determined more likely than not hazed members or committed other misconduct. But the assembly's analysis of the records found that despite these requirements, some fraternities continued to engage in a pattern of insubordination. In one case, in 2019, NC State found Kappa Alpha Order responsible for hazing and other conduct violations. The hearing officer wrote there was, quote, strong evidence that removing the chapter from campus could, quote, provide benefit for the university. But instead he opted to assign sanctions, including a roughly 2.5-year probation, quote, that will hopefully create a pathway to success. That chapter was still on probation from that incident when it accepted responsibility for hazing involving other incidents in 2021. NC State revoked its recognition. Members of Pi Kappa Alpha, which faced a 4-year exile from state in 2013 for significant conduct issues, defied the university's order and continued hazing. Members said, quote, this culture was still deeply ingrained in the organization when the chapter recolonized on campus in 2017. NC State again revoked the recognition in 2019 after it pleaded responsible for hazing for the second time in as many years. Appalachian State permanently revoked Delta Chi's recognition in 2021 after a resident assistant reported the pledges came into dorm, quote, with blue lips, wearing similar attire, and showing signs of intoxication. In a letter detailing a conduct board's findings, a university official said the chapter flouted the terms of previous sanction and an interim suspension, which, quote, led the board to decide that revocation of the university recognition is the most appropriate sanction. At times, no kidding, university administrators seemed exasperated. One former Charlotte administrator said, it seems like every week we have a similar conversation about how they need to hold themselves accountable and work to live out the values of Sigma Chi and the fraternity experience. I personally am not seeing this chapter grow in the direction our office would expect. Hazing has long been deeply rooted on college campuses. In 1913, following a hazing death at UNC Chapel Hill, state lawmakers made hazing a misdemeanor. But now, prosecutors seldom bring successful hazing charges, show state court statistics. In the past 10 years, district attorneys have opened 9 hazing cases statewide, and most were dismissed. Kimberly Spouse, executive director of the North Carolina Conference of District Attorneys, said there are several reasons for this. First, until the law was amended last year, prosecutors were required to show the conduct resulted in physical injury, which isn't always the case. When hazing has caused physical injuries, prosecutors have pursued assault-related charges, Spouse said in an email statement, adding that prosecutors also can have trouble gathering evidence to prove a case because it typically occurs within close-knit groups, and participants are often reluctant to cooperate with law enforcement. And, she wrote, many hazing incidents are addressed through university or student conduct processes rather than referred for criminal prosecution, especially when the behavior does not rise to the level of a criminal offense under state law. Hazing is not exclusive to social Greek letter groups, but research shows they and varsity sports are where the problem is most acute. A nationwide 2008 survey of college students found 7 out of 10 students in these groups reported experiencing hazing at least once. The survey, which is considered the most expansive study of hazing to date, concluded that hazing is, quote, woven into the fabric of student life and campus culture. The next section of this article, Harrison's Law. On a late Monday night, November 2008, the landline in Leon Koviak's Tampa, Florida home rang. It was the emergency department at Frye Medical Center in Hickory, North Carolina. Kowiak's son, Harrison, then a sophomore, attending Lenore Ryan on golf and academic scholarships, was rushing for Theta Chi. His big brother in the fraternity told her Harrison, 19, fell while trying to catch a football and hit his head. Harrison's injuries were too serious for the regional hospital to treat. He was airlifted to Carolina's Medical Center in Charlotte. Leon Kowiak recalled at a recent UNC Chapel Hill visit where she spoke to students about hazing prevention, "I was shaking like a leaf." She said she flew to Charlotte the next morning and went straight to the hospital. About 24 Theta Chi brothers lined the hallway of the intensive care unit. They had bloodshot eyes, and some were covered in mud, she said. Harrison had suffered severe brain trauma. Leon Kowiak's husband and daughter flew to Charlotte to say goodbye, and Harrison died on November 18, 2008. In the following weeks, the fraternity brothers' initial account of the night of Kowiak's injury began to unravel. Investigators with the Catawba County Sheriff's Office said there were discrepancies in witness statement, but concluded there was no foul play, the Charlotte Observer reported. According to the Chronicle of Higher Education, prosecutors didn't file criminal charges because there wasn't enough evidence. Leon Kowiak, he said, she hired private investigators who found Harrison was forced to run the gauntlet at an off-campus field in a late-night initiation ritual known as bulldogging for the chapter's Hell Week. In a wrongful death lawsuit against Theta Chi, Lenore Ryan and several fraternity members, the Kowiak family alleged that Harrison was repeatedly tackled by Theta Chi brothers, some of whom were nearly 100 pounds heavier than him. The fraternity and some of its members paid more than $4.5 million to settle that lawsuit in 2011. Theta Chi, which denied wrongdoing, no longer operates at Lenore Ryan. Apologize for that background noise. Our poltergeist acting up here at the studios. As time passed, Leanne Kowiak said her grief fueled a drive to keep Harrison's legacy alive, and she slowly struck up a relationship with leaders at the Theta Chi headquarters, where she began to speak about hazing prevention at the fraternity's annual conference. In 2019, she started advocating for a stronger hazing law in North Carolina. Her early efforts to reach state lawmakers were futile, so Kowiak enlisted the help of Theta Chi CEO Michael Mayer, who connected her with an NC State Theta Chi alumnus and childhood friend of lobbyist David Powers. Powers, who previously served on the UNC Board of Governors and now sits on NC State's Board of Trustees, told the assembly he lobbied for the bill pro bono. He said Theta Chi sent him draft language and he recruited two sponsors, Senator Amy Gailey and Representative Steve Ross, both Alamance Republicans. The bill passed both chambers with bipartisan support, and Governor Stein signed it into law last July. The section that amends North Carolina's hazing statutes is titled Harrison's Law. It expands the definition of hazing to include acts that inflict serious psychological injury rather than solely physical injury. Students convicted of hazing, which has been bumped to the highest class of misdemeanor, could now face up to 5 months in jail, which is consistent with the penalty for an assault that causes serious injury. Previously, the maximum sentence was 2 months and a $1,000 fine. Harrison's law also creates a new felony charge for school staff who engage in or aid and abet hazing, which Ross said was prompted by an incident in his and Gailey's district. In March, the Alamance News reported that a mother of a Southern Alamance High School wrestler said he suffered a traumatic brain injury after his coach told him he had to participate in a drill called Circle of Death or quit the team. Joshua Jessica Epley told Assembly that her then 14-year-old son, Colby, was forced to wrestle his teammates and an assistant coach. At one point, she said his head was slammed into a cinder block wall and he later passed out. Jessica Epley said it was a complete and utter misuse of power on so many different levels, like it was just disgusting. The coaches were not charged with a crime in connection with the case, Gailey said. Regardless, Epley's allegations made clear the state hazing law did not adequately address situations in which a school staff member is involved. And Gailey said, we need to be a society that looks after each other and doesn't expect outsiders to endure dangerous hardships so they can belong. Well, to Kowiak's consternation, Harrison's law looks vastly different from the initial seven-bill page that was filed in March. The first version of the bill is almost identical to a model state legislation put forth by the Anti-Hazing Coalition, of which Kowiak is a founding member. That is a collaboration of parents who have lost children to hazing and trade groups, including the NIC, that represents some of the oldest and largest Greek letter social organizations. In May, a Senate committee gutted most of the language, including measures that would have banned consent as a defense and made hazing a felony if it results in serious injury or death. Ross said he asked his colleagues to pare it down because his priority was the provision that criminalized hazing for school staff. With too expansive of a bill, he said, you run the risk of having it, quote, stuck on the shelf in rules, referring to the powerful House Rules Committee. But Doug Feierberg, a lawyer who represents hazing victims and their families nationwide, said the final statute is practically toothless. Quote, what the North Carolina law suggests to me is that the fraternity industry has its fingerprints all over it. 30 of the 44 states with an anti-hazing law says a crime can occur, even if the victim effectively consents to participation, according to an advocacy group called Stop Hazing. North Carolina does not have that language, and courts have dismissed hazing charges on the basis that the victim chose to participate in the experiences gone awry. In 2014, for example, a Montgomery County judge ruled that four UNC Charlotte fraternity men weren't responsible for the near-death experience of a Pi Kappa Alpha pledge who was hospitalized with a blood alcohol level more than five times the legal limit. The pledge's attorney told WSOC-TV that 15 pledges were told to chug beer and hard liquor at a campout in Uwari National Forest. Under cross-examination in court, the pledge testified he wasn't forced to go to the campus or drink once he was there. The judge threw out hazing charges against three men and found the fourth not guilty. UNC closed the fraternity for 8 years. North Carolina is one of four states where victims cannot recover damages in a lawsuit if they are found to be even 1% responsible for the injury. That means if a jury decides a hazing victim is partly to blame because they voluntarily participated in a potentially dangerous act, like standing in a pledge line, quote, you have no civil legal remedy, said Feierberg. Gailey, the senator, said in dire circumstances, a student accused of hazing could be charged with other felony crimes. Lawmakers chose to keep hazing a misdemeanor charge because, quote, a college kid who has been a bonehead and had something unfortunate happen on their watch, you want them to be held accountable, but you don't necessarily want their life to be ruined. Kowiak sees it differently. She said a potential felony charge for hazing that results in serious harm would be a strong deterrent for students. Kowiak said, hazing obviously can get out of control easily. Do I think these individuals at Chapter at Lenoir Rhine intend to murder someone? No. But if they didn't go down that path of hazing, just this ritual, which happened year after year after year for that chapter, if that didn't happen, maybe my son would be here. Still, Kowiak stressed that the passage of Harrison's Law is a monumental hurdle that we've crossed. In an email statement, in response to detailed questions, Mayor, the Theta Chi CEO, said in part, "We are grateful for our friendship with Leon Kowiak and our shared mission to prevent hazing on college campuses, and we are glad the state of North Carolina joined us in our efforts." To extinguish hazing, Gary and Julie DiPerselli think individual accountability is insufficient. The couple lost their eldest son, Gary Jr., to a hazing ritual on March 30th, 2007. He was a first-year student at Rider University in New Jersey when he died of alcohol poisoning after drinking most of a bottle of vodka at the Phi Kappa Tau fraternity house. Julie DiPerselli said, "Too often when hazing happens, the current fraternity members are cast as the culprit." She said she thinks national fraternities and universities let hazing culture fester. "That's why they always close the house down or shut them down for 4 years or 5 years, and then it happens again," she said. Spurred by their son's death, the DiPerselli's spent 10 years and dozens of trips to Capitol Hill from their home in California, advocating for federal anti-hazing law. In the past, lobbyists for Greek letter groups have stymied similar efforts. National fraternities can leverage powerful assets to influence policymakers at all levels of government. The groups enjoy a wide alumni base with outsized representation in leadership positions. 7% of men and 6% of women say they've been members of a collegiate Greek letter social group. Yet the assembly found that at least one-third of members of the UNC Board of Governors are fraternity or sorority alumni. The ratio is roughly the same in the 119th U.S. Congress. The DiPersellis, who sit on the board of the nonprofit Clery Center, said they found a champion for an anti-hazing bill in U.S. Representative Lucy McBath, a Georgia Democrat and Delta Sigma Theta alumnus. National fraternity and sorority trade groups supported its passage. The resulting bipartisan legislation, which President Joe Biden signed into law in 2024, is the first of its kind. The Stop Campus Hazing Act requires colleges and universities that receive federal funding to track hazing incidents and include that tally in their annual report of crime statistics, known as the Clery Report. The act also mandates that these schools implement hazing prevention policies and issue a biannual transparency report that summarizes findings of any investigation of student organizations found responsible for hazing. The reporting requirements are designed to provide the most detailed look yet at the extent of hazing in higher education, especially at private universities, which are largely exempt from state public records laws. The deadline for the first transparency report was last month. The DiPersellis hope the transparency requirements will apprise students and their families of the potential risks when they consider joining a student organization. They want to see national fraternities and universities held accountable for hazing. And Gary DiPerselli said, "Once the general public is made aware of how deep and pervasive this problem is, it's going to spark outrage. And then we're going to get some legislation, which I hope will hold the people in charge responsible." Finally, our announcements about, well, winter preparedness for you all. People with disabilities may want to take extra care during the cold weather season. Some disabling conditions may limit sensory abilities and the ability to maintain body heat. So, be particularly careful about staying warm when you are out in low temperatures. Here are tips for being prepared for cold weather. and I won't have time to nearly cover all of them that are offered, but I'll capsulize them. Wear multiple layers of clothing, including a scarf around the neck, a winter hat, lined boots, and two pairs of socks. If possible, wear thermal gloves. Wear waterproof insulated boots to keep your feet warm and dry, and maintain your footing in ice and snow. Sign up for local alerts and warnings. Create and test an emergency communication plan. If you receive home-based care, like an attendant, home health aide, visiting nurse service, include these caregivers in developing your plan. Familiarize yourself with your home care agency's emergency plan. Store a talking or braille clock or large print timepiece with extra batteries if you have a visual disability. Stock emergency supplies and install battery-powered or battery-backed-up carbon monoxide detectors and smoke detectors. I consider this one urgent because you could set up a heating system or a fire or something inside your home, and you're subject to the same dangers of smoke inhalation, poisonous gas, or whatever. So that's a good one to remember. Next, plan ahead for accessible transportation that you may need for evacuation or getting to a clinic. Work with local services, public transport, or paratransit to identify your local or private transportation options. How about first responders? Be ready to explain that you need to evacuate and choose to go to a shelter with family, service animal, caregiver, personal assistant, or your assistive technology devices and supplies. They need to know that to help get you there. If you are dependent on dialysis or other life-sustaining treatment, know the location and availability of more than one facility. Inform your support network. Folks, I can't overstress this one. Your support network, who are they? Members of your church, next-door neighbors, other people like that, and you can be in their support group too. Support doesn't mean they have to carry you on their shoulders somewhere. My wife and I were helped supported by a next-door neighbor's extension cord back when Hurricane Fran hit. That's my idea. Tell them where you keep your emergency supplies. You might want to consider give a member a key to your house or apartment. All right, that's all the time we have for today. We wish our listeners to be safe, warm, dry, and taken care of. And take care of yourself, please. This stuff that's coming in to Central North Carolina, not to be like something we've experienced to this degree in the recent past, anyway, unless you lived in Buffalo, New York. John Fetterson then for Indie Week, saying stay warm, dry, and safe. Bye-bye from the North Carolina Reading Service.